Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday morning. It's the 24th of July, the keyword being Friday, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we welcome you all to the program. A delight, as always, that people congregate and listen all at once at the some people, you know, they listen later on. Maybe you're listening. Maybe when you hear our voice, you're hearing it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on your way home. But regardless, you're with us, and that's all that we really care about. We wish you well, and we thank you very much for taking part in our program. You can do even more if you want to send us a letter. Send us an email, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and you can take part that way. We would love to hear what you have to say on the long list of issues we have to discuss this morning. A lot of heavy lifting, nothing easy about the issues that we're going to be discussing this morning. Let me introduce the panel to you. Former EPA Regional Administrator, Visiting Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck is here. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm good.
Wonderful to have you, as always. Immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is with us. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Morning, Joe.
Very nice
to be back.
Wonderful to have you back. And president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Brichetti. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you here. Well, and I saved Alan to the last because, he's going to tomorrow, not today, but tomorrow, he's going to be a birthday boy. Ooh. Very exciting.
Well, it's very exciting. And, you know, somewhat disturbing, but what can I tell you?
You just take the exciting part. You take the cake and the exciting part.
Well, I don't eat of cake. You should probably know that's a carbohydrate and sugar.
Yeah, but you'll have a piece.
Yeah, but the family's coming and it'll be great.
It'll be great. We got a note already. This one was from Elizabeth, who said, "Happy birthday, doctor. We have been blessed in this area by benefiting from your work and insight in political issues. You are a true, honest person. May God give you many more successful years." And that is from Elizabeth. And we wish you a very happy birthday. How are you going to celebrate other than you'll have the whole family around? That'll be great.
No other celebration, just maybe an extra nap.
No fireworks, no.
No, okay. All right. We don't do fireworks here. The people who do fireworks in Great Barrington, have not been getting good notice.
Yes. All right. Well, we wish you a very, very happy birthday.
Thank you, Joseph. That's very kind of you.
Very sweet to celebrate in some small way with you. I have to say, if people want to send in their happy birthday messages, we'll put a few moments at the end and we'll read them. We'll read them.
Well, we don't have to do that, but it would be great if somebody could say, I don't want any presents, but it would be great if somebody could say, you know, this station is worth having. Everywhere I go, people are talking to me about about how they listen to this panel, Joe, and they have nothing but praise for you and what you've done here and the great people on the panel, and they say it is such a relief to have it. Somebody wants to put something into the pot, this station can always, always use it. It would be great.
I hope you don't take offense to what I'm about to say, but
Yes, I do. No, I don't know.
For years and years and years, you know, forever, for time immemorium, people will say, you read at the bottom of an obit where it'll say, in lieu of flowers, you can give money to.
Right.
And instead, when people now on Facebook are doing this thing where they say, on my birthday, to celebrate my birthday, I would like you to make a donation to this particular cause. That seems much more sensible to me. You know, enjoy it. Enjoy the
while you're there.
While you're there, exactly. Yeah.
Not when you're dead.
No. Well, I mean, both. You know, both are fine for the organizations.
No, I hear you.
But by the same token, it is lovely to have you know how loved you are and have people do it in that way. So that's a nice thing.
You know how I love this station, Joe, and we all do, and we've all worked our hearts out to make sure it survives. And that'll never be easy, and it hasn't been from the very beginning. It's great to see all of the people do something, but anybody who can do something today will cheer me up even more than I am, and I'm pretty cheerful today.
Well, we want to keep you cheerful. So happy, happy birthday to you. And as I said, we'd love to hear from our listeners. And yeah, anything you can do. It's WAMC.org and or give us a call. And we can certainly put it toward the Allen Birthday Fund to celebrate the station, which will all go on the lockbox because we have a fun drive coming up in October, which really isn't all that far away.
Just keeps coming around.
And you know what happens right after October? That's right. Election Day.
Oh, boy.
All right. So let's get to the so happy birthday, Allen. We'll get to we'll talk a little bit more about that. But let me get to the topics for today. Election Day, I bring up because we learned yesterday through the president's briefing that he is canceling the Republican National Convention, the portion of the Republican National Convention, the live portion that would have been in Jacksonville, Florida. You will remember this was originally supposed to be in North Carolina, in Charlotte. Then they moved because they said, oh, well, North Carolina wasn't really thrilled that they could have a packed convention and have a, you know, big, loud and boisterous convention hall. And so they went to Jacksonville. And then from the time that happened to now, the numbers in Florida for COVID have just skyrocketed. And finally, the president yesterday canceled the Republican National Convention celebration scheduled for next month in Jacksonville, making the latest in a series of head-snapping reversals in the face of a nationwide pandemic that continues to spread out of control. That from the Washington Post. Trump has for months instructed his advisors to find a way to stage a loud, boisterous, and packed convention celebration after North Carolina officials said they could not guarantee such an event in Charlotte. Advisors scoured the country for a new location to host a multi-night televised spectacle, settling on Jacksonville, where the mayor and Florida's governor are Trump allies. However, they ran headlong into a massive spike in the coronavirus cases in Florida, growing local opposition, and enormous logistical hurdles. So it has been called off. What do you think, Alan?
Well, look, Joe Biden from the very beginning saw it coming. He was right. They decided that they were going to do it all virtually, and they said so, and they kept their heads down. In the meantime, braggadocio Trump thumps his chest and says, we're going ahead with it. We're going to have all these people, thousands of people there, and we don't particularly care. That's the message, parenthesis, whether people are going to drop as a result of this. Well, you know, I think one of the reasons the numbers keep going down and down and down is because there is a sense that he just doesn't care about other human beings other than himself. And I think that's what it is.
Well, it is. As I said, it is somewhat head spinning, but it certainly makes sense. Judith, what do you make of it?
Well, yesterday alone, Florida had about 10,000 new cases, making them number three in the country for COVID infections. So I actually think this was a responsible decision the president.
Yeah.
You know, we can debate how he got there. You know, the polls in Florida, 62% of people said it would be unsafe to have the convention. And he's trailing Biden in Florida. Biden has 51% to Trump's 38%. And remember, Trump won Florida in 2016 just by one percentage point. So I think that all went into the mix. But I think he got to the right spot. And the big question for me is if the president thinks it's not safe to have the leadership of the Republican Party and their delegates in conventions, and a lot of conventions are not always in the big hall, it's smaller venues. If it's not safe for Republicans to gather, why is it safe to send school children back to school in Florida in a few weeks? I hope that same care will be exercised when it comes to kids' health.
I think you put far too much thought into this.
Me too. By the way, am I allowed to disagree? because, you know, with the gentle person from Bennington in New York and all. And that is, you know, you give him credit and say this was the responsible thing for him to do. Since when has this guy started to be responsible about anything? No, he sat with a bunch of suits. They looked at the figures. They said, we're going to get clobbered. We're looking into the future. If we do this, we're going to get it. It's just one more way we're going to get clobbered, and we can't do it. I think that's what happened. I don't think it was a matter of responsibility at all.
I totally agree, but the decision was the right one, and it will save some lives. So that's good thing.
Yeah, but good. But it sounds like you're giving him some credit. I don't think he deserves.
Yeah, stop that.
I don't think he deserves any credit on this thing.
Heather, what do you think?
Well, so a couple things. First, it was the right decision. I agree with that 100%. It took them too long to get there. To me, the sort of fascinating thing is in the Republican Party, I mean, yesterday afternoon, Florida papers reported that 7 out of 10 Republicans still think it's safe to have the convention. And obviously, before he pulled the rug out from under the RNC, who had to scramble, spend a huge amount of money to, which, by the way, was the wrong decision. They should have canceled it a month ago, or, you know, they should have canceled it when they saw that it couldn't happen in North Carolina. I think there's this partisan nature to this virus that is they're starting to recognize that the numbers, the facts are just going to speak for themselves. And as much as you want to believe that this isn't a big deal, it is a big deal. But I'm just absolutely stunned that 7 out of 10 Republicans polled in Florida believed that it was perfectly safe. I mean, I just don't even understand that.
Well, can you guess? How about a guess why 7 out of 10? I mean, we can have some fun, right? How does 7 out of
it's your birthday weekend? It's nothing but fun.
How could 7 out of 10?
To the extent that people look to. They make this a partisan issue. They're going to, you know, double down on their beliefs, regardless of whether or not the facts look otherwise. And of course, you've already had the sort of disparagement of media sources. So people think, well, you know, they're overblowing it or it's not that big a deal. And it's just the media trying to hurt Trump. Well, by making it a partisan issue with the facts as they are, it's going to continue to hurt him. So you saw some big shifts in his tenor in the last couple of days, including, by the way, saying that some of the schools are not going to be able to open on time. And that's a startling reversal. The wearing of a mask is a big reversal. So, I mean, at some point, they recognize that the reality is going to overwhelm Republican and partisan rhetoric.
Sienna, what do you think?
Listen, I think he made the right decision. I think he did it just for political reasons. I really believe that. But I'm really thinking about what Judith said and what this means for school children. Because that's the question that's going on in every household, including my own right now, is we're waiting to see what's going to happen when we go back to school. I think that might be a bigger political move than this rally, is seeing what happens when you force all these children back into the school. And if the numbers go up, that could be catastrophic politically for him and, you know, personally for the American people. So I really think what the issue that everyone's thinking about right now is, okay, great, you canceled the Jacksonville rally. What about the kids?
Right.
And I know he kind of rode it back a little bit at the hearing, at the press conference yesterday, but he didn't take it far enough. And I think that's the real implications for the November election, is what's going to happen when the kids go back to school.
Judith?
And I would add the Florida Teachers Union has sued about requiring all teachers going back. And I might just add that the president's own son, Barron, who goes to a private school, is not fully opening outside of Washington, D.C. So it might be good to look at what it went into the decision making at St. Andrew's Episcopal and see if that could also be applied to public schools.
Yeah, but since when has hypocrisy played a part in decision making in this case?
Especially by this guy.
Yeah, that's, well, yes. Oh, yes, Heather.
I was just gonna say. I mean, the schools issue is one that is hugely complex because you can't fully recover people, even assuming that people could go back to work. Those who have school-aged children, a lot of them are not going to be able to do that if schools aren't reopened. And, you know, even in partial, you know, to the extent that people are able to do the split, like is being proposed in a lot of schools in New York, some days remote, some days in person with social distancing measures, the remote piece of it still requires, you know, some kind of alternative childcare arrangement during the day. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very complicated issue. And I mean, certainly the fact that that children tend to be more likely to be asymptomatic carriers, and then you overlay it with the fact that things like school bus drivers, the average age, they tend to be older. A lot of retirees, I'm hearing from other states that they have tried to start the reopening process, they can't get the school bus drivers to come back. So, I mean, there are so many interrelated parts that just really shows the importance of having planning around all of this moving forward.
Okay, yeah, that is the problem. Heather, what should we do?
Well, I mean, I think we need to have real scientific metrics on and a much better understanding of transmission before we put everybody back in a classroom. But I think we also need to really make sure that to the extent that people can work remotely and can do school remotely, that the infrastructure is in place for that. Because, you know, I've been talking to folks at the national level about the possibility of an infrastructure bill, which does not look like it's going to happen this year. And we need to start thinking about access to broadband as infrastructure, because it's going to be essential. So, I mean, I don't, if I had the answer, I would share it. You know,
You're the empress.
Give us an answer. 20 seconds.
Sounds like keep them out, right? Keep them out till we know more. Isn't that what it sounds like?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that has to be the answer.
When we come back, Joe, one state legislator thinks he has the answer. Maybe I can talk about that just when we come back.
Of course. Absolutely. A birthday present for Alan.
That's so nice.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Your well wishes for Alan as well. We'll be back and continue our conversation right after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Sanna Freeman-Tolbert, and Heather Bruschetti making up the group this morning. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Alan, we're going to you to... you were going to bring a local connection into this conversation.
One state legislator, Joe, thought that businesses, if I get this right, I think I heard it on our news yesterday, thinks that businesses ought to do parental leave, paid parental leave for anybody who works for the business. I don't know how the others feel about it, but you want to do the right thing, but you also want to keep going. So it's an interesting dilemma. Because if the government were paying it, well, maybe. But if the businesses themselves, which are struggling so hard now, are going to pay that, that might be a little tougher. Although I get it, I really get it.
Anyone on that? Heather, would you like to handle that?
Heather,
yeah.
I'll go after Heather.
I think, you know, when I said I think that they should stay home, I think we also need to recognize difference between high school and elementary school and who requires constant supervision and all of that. To just throw out there paid parental leave for everyone it depends a lot on who pays for it. I mean, as it is right now, we're estimating that about a third of small businesses are going to close permanently. So, you know, the money has to come from somewhere. And if we don't have productivity, the money won't be there. So it'll just be unemployment for everyone. And that's, you know, that doesn't sustain us. I think we need to be thinking harder about things like job sharing and like, you know, the creativity of the schools and saying a couple days in, a couple days out, there might be some moving parts and things that we haven't thought of that can make that actually work. Right.
and it might require a lot more use of technology in terms of how do you get people to school without having, you know, dense transportation. And there's a lot of thought that needs to go into all of it. I know the schools have done a huge amount of work on this, and some of them have come up with some really very innovative plans. But on the employer side, too, recognizing that some parents are going to have to be home some of the time, are there things we can do with not just remote work, but those that have to be physically present in the workplace? Can we do job sharing? Can we have people split jobs? Can we change shift hours so that it's not during the school day? I mean, there's a lot of creativity that that hasn't been put into place yet.
A lot of creativity, but also a lot of choreography. And it seems like there has to be give on all sides to make this work for all parties involved. And that's not to say that it can't happen. It certainly can. And I agree with your optimism when it comes to the creativity. But one of the things that really strikes me about this, Heather, and I came to this conclusion as I was listening to you talk just a few moments ago, you know, TikTok, school's going to start in a month. We don't have a lot of time to figure a lot of this out.
No.
And in Florida,
no, that's why
starts...
it needs to be all hands on deck.
Yeah.
Well, I think the answer is kind of obvious. It's we have to stop community spread. So in communities where you have high rates, which, you know, these numbers are just astonishing. We are in a mass casualty event as a country. The cases in nationwide doubled in the last 6 weeks, doubled. So we're now at 4 million, and the trajectory is it keeps going up. However, individual communities are different. Vermont and New Hampshire are different from Florida and Texas. So if you don't have a community spread problem, you can do the innovative, creative things that Heather speaks of, although I will add, you know, not everyone has Zoomable jobs. You know, people who have to work in stores, and I think Heather's point on changing shifts is good. I mean, it's just, you know, childcare is really hard when you're not in the middle of a pandemic. So I think it comes back to what Trump has failed to recognize from the beginning. If you want the economy to reopen, if you want our precious children back in school, you have to stop community spread of the virus. And he's still not providing the resources to do that. In New York City now, the wait time to get your COVID test result is approaching a week, which makes it kind of pointless. All the labs are backed up. Once the college kids come back on campus, and most of them required to be testing, the testing situation is going to go off the cliff once again.
I'm sure there is a reasonable, and obviously this has been thought about, but every time I drive by the UAlbany campus, the entire campus is a testing site now. I just don't know how you were, but those kids also have to get tested, and how you're going to bring them back on top of that just seems, I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm sure they have a plan, but wow. I mean, it's like moving a city. It seems like it's very, very big work ahead.
It is a city, Joe. I got lost there the other day. I was on my way to get a shot on Western Avenue,
yeah.
And I somehow got into the bowels of where I used to teach, which was quite easy. But somehow, you know, I found it very difficult to get out.
And so much of that, and so much to the, if you're facing the campus, to the right and to the left are taken up by these huge testing sites, and which is great for testing because they can get through so many people very quickly. But you do wonder how you're going to add a college into that.
I want the governor to come back and to keep talking to me. But he did say to me the other day on the air that New York was doing the testing better than anybody else because we were using our own resources and we had it all set up. Not so fast.
A perfect segue, but the governor will be on.
Before you jump...
No, I'll come right to you, Sienna, I promise. I just want to say quickly, the governor will be on today at 11:30. He's giving a briefing at 11:30, and we'll carry that live. I think he's doing it from New York City, or Red Room. I apologize, Red Room from Albany at 11:30. Sienna, go ahead.
I was just going to say that you know, I understand looking at it locally and trying to figure out which schools can reopen in different areas based on what's happening in the area. And as a parent, so I'm watching, like, even in Albany County, we had an uptick on Thursday of 29 cases because someone had a party. And when you mm-hmm. see numbers can just jump that quickly in a small area, it just raises your red flag. So even
one party, 30
Vermont,
people,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah. One party, so 30 people.
One party, 30 people. And so that just raises your red flag to say, wait, I know it may feel safe, but this virus is moving and it, you know, it does not discriminate. So if my children go to school and, you know, they are and they meet, they're with someone who was with an uncle who came from Georgia, you know, that weekend, automatically is coming home. And where does it go from there? I think it is more complex and it's very complicated because just like that, a pseudo safe area becomes a hotspot. And so that's my concern. When you're bringing children from all different walks of life into one place.
Let's go to some letters here on this subject. Gary says, I've heard more good ideas about opening schools this morning from the panel than in all the time leading to now, so thank you. Unfortunately, these solutions require active, committed, cooperative, responsible partnership among schools, commerce, and government on all levels. Until now, schools have been expected to solve the problems by themselves with commerce and government standing by. I think probably, Heather, you would have something to say about the commerce part. I know the business community has been involved.
Yeah, I absolutely have. And I think we've got large groups of people across the country who are trying to come up with ideas to solve some of these. I mean, the groups that I'm talking to nationally are all business groups who are all trying to brainstorm how do we help schools get reopened safely. And, you know, and then there's the social concern for children, too. You know, it's not good for them to be not socializing with each other. And Zoom, you know, is good, but it's not the same.
I think we should say that one of the interesting things here is that in 19, you know, I'm old enough to remember the 1950s and 60s, where not my mom who worked, but a lot of women did work. They stayed home. They were the childcare people. They're not doing that, thank God, anymore. And we're on the way to some kind of equality. We're not quite there yet.
You mean there aren't a lot of suburban housewives?
Exactly. although there are if you watch television.
Oh,
did when you read that tweet, Suburban Housewives?
Yes.
Didn't you think it was like a preview of a new show he was going to launch on Bravo next year?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't see it. What did he say?
He was talking about, well, Judith, you were involved in the story, so I'll let you set it up.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I'm very proud of this. So the president did a tweet yesterday, his racist narrative, saying that Joe Biden's housing policies were going to destroy suburbia. I mean, those are not his words, but in his tweet, he said, you know, something like suburban housewives need to know about Joe Biden's housing policies. And I responded in a tweet that suburban housewives will pay attention to this tweet. Thank you, Fred Flintstone. Love, Wilma. and I couldn't believe that he's using the phrase suburban housewives to reach his suburban female voters that he's trying to reach.
Which he carried, Judith, the last time. That's what's so interesting about this. They are desperate to win this election. And so what happens is they're looking at the places where they're most vulnerable. And that's one of them. And they're losing. And they're losing big right now. So right. That's what that was all about.
And in one of those stories where they were saying that people were freaking out over the president using the term suburban housewives, Judith's tweet got picked up and replicated, which was really cool to see. So that was neat. We actually we had another one. The roundtable and WAMC got mentioned in the comment section of the New York Times crossword yesterday.
No.
Too. Yeah.
What?
This is so Rich.
It doesn't get bigger than that.
So our good buddy Rich Honan was upset. Well, not upset. He wrote a comment in the New York Times crossword puzzle column. And it was really good. And he made a joke about usually disagreeing with the Times, but he, you know, he was giving them props. And so today they printed his comment, but the moderator apparently had to delete a bunch of the responses because they were inappropriate personal attacks.
Was it Congress member Yoho?
No.
Was he deleted?
But so Rich didn't get to see that, but the one that the moderator left was a guy who said that he had heard Rich on the round table and knew that he had a thick skin, so that was that was cool. All good stuff. I still owe you a break, don't I? Do I owe you a break? Yeah, we have to go take a break.
We'll give him a break.
Yeah, we'll give us all a break. We'll come back. We have many letters. We'll do that right after this. Playing the music of Moses Sumney this morning. You can see the playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. We've got about 10 minutes before we have to take a break at the top of the hour, and we got a lot of letters, so let me go to those. Tom says, before a vaccine is developed and COVID goes away, I believe we need to realize that we are playing an entirely different ball game than we were before COVID. The first rule is to prevent as many people as possible from getting infected. This virus kills. Keep the schools closed, then figure out how to accomplish what needs to be accomplished, including providing all students with equal access to quality distance learning. This requires unified action from all parties under inspiring leadership. Beth says, we've already seen how the virus will spread when schools open. There are outbreaks in childcare facilities now, a micro school setting. Also, Christine says, I'm terribly concerned about our rural schools who have very poor internet access to most of the homes, including teachers. I would love your comments. Happy birthday, Alan. Today is our 10th anniversary. So happy anniversary, Christine, and happy. Ooh. Who says happy birthday to you, Alan? Great point about the rural schools, though. Judith, anything on that?
Yeah. Well, so I just think that's right, and that's why we have to start thinking about access to broadband as infrastructure, and it's something that the business community has been, you know, really pushing in New York in particular. There's a lot of parts of upstate where you can't really start a small business online because you don't have broadband. So, I mean, it just highlights how integral it is as a part of everyday life at this point.
Judith?
Yeah, and I think it points to the yet another failure on infrastructure. You know, the running joke in Washington is, it's infrastructure week again. And
yeah,
infrastructure investments, including broadband and upgrading sewage treatment plants and drinking water supplies and mass transit and roads and bridges, I would do it in that order. You know, there's bipartisan agreement that there should be new federal spending on that. And, you know, I know my Congress member, Antonio Delgado, has been really pushing hard on the broadband issue. You just have to look at his sprawling district, which is many rural communities. But this is the day-to-day implication of having an incompetent Trump administration. You know, you put aside all the ideological battles, just the business of running government. You know, even a mediocre leader could have worked with Congress to get an infrastructure bill through and not just keep talking about infrastructure week. And so these kids and businesses in rural areas are in crisis in this pandemic because they can't do what many others are able to do. And for so many, if they do have a Zoomable job, but you have dial-up, it's not going to work.
Fred writes to us and says, I want to raise an issue that confuses many people. Schools were not closed since March. The school buildings were closed. I, as a teacher, probably worked double time during that period. Not only did I hold online classes and extra help hours, I created online tests and daily quizzes to keep students current. And I also created over 70 videos, averaging half an hour each, to present the information and help students learn over what is available in print form. In addition, I found auxiliary online videos to help. Even now on quote-unquote summer break, I spend my days preparing such materials for all my classes. The best teachers continue to work even harder than before. Parents are not teaching their children. What they have inherited via COVID is the classroom management, making sure that students are focused and on task. Thanks for discussing. And that's an important point, and we thank Fred for making it.
Joe, I think that's a very important clarification, because the schools weren't closed since March. I know I have a kindergartner, and we were working every day through the end of until the end of June, almost.
Right.
And the teachers were working very, very hard. And so I think that's an important clarification. I mean, our kindergarten teacher came and did a drive-by to wave at the kids. I mean, so they were definitely working. I don't think that I have school-age children. So school-age children, it's just not, I don't see how it's realistic to have, like, send them back to school and put a mask on their face. My daughter had a mask on. It was on her eyes, it was on her ear, but it was never on her, covering her nose and her mouth unless I was holding it there. So I am just one of those very frustrated parents right now, just waiting to see what they decide. So that was a good letter. It's good clarification, because the kids are learning.
Yeah.
And we are assisting the parents. And there is social interaction to some extent.
Here's a related letter from Virginia.
Hey, Alan, I can't hear you.
Oh, yeah, that's because I don't have the thing up to
my face. There you go.
I'm sorry.
That's
all
right.
I'm trying to read and drink coffee and do all the other things at the same time. Okay. My daughter, says Virginia, is a kindergarten teacher, and I'm very worried about her returning to school. Educators failed to mention that kindergarten is not like other grades. The children constantly move around, touching each other, and it is very difficult to keep them from sharing art supplies, pencils, paper books, etc., and would be impossible to make them keep their masks on. It is very worrisome. That's Virginia from Florida. I think our Florida, not the other
one. Yeah, the Massachusetts, Florida. Well, Sienna, that's exactly what you were saying about your kindergartner.
Yeah.
We have grandchildren of that age, and believe me, nobody's going to tell them what to do. They're just going to do it.
Yeah. Who else? I'm sorry, Yeah, Heather.
I was just going to say that makes me think of two separate things. Number one, you know, getting back to the really big importance of contact tracing and, you know, because that is a big part of preventing these, you know, parties from turning into a community spread. But the other piece of it, in talking about the teacher who sounds like he was an awesome teacher, is there an opportunity for us to look at the teachers who are doing this so, so well and make some of their instruction available to students who aren't inside their district walls? I mean, there is inequity in between districts. And, I'm not suggesting that they should now have a virtual classroom of 500 kids, but some of their better stuff maybe can be shared to districts that don't have the kind of resources that that his district or really flush districts have.
Garrett,
I think that's it's a good idea, and my goodness, I'm glad that teacher wrote in, because we need to be reminded every day how hard it is for teachers.
Absolutely.
We all know teachers, right? And they're doing double duty, and they're also checking in individually with their students who they think are falling behind, or, you know, we know teachers who, you know, three kids in the family sharing one tablet. It's just unbelievable. And thank you for all the teachers, and we need to recognize that as a society.
Yeah, I'd like to say that. I'd second that and say they work hard and they are underpaid and in regular times. And this is really something unbelievable.
We have just a few minutes before our top of the hour break. I want to get as many letters in as we can before then. Joanna says, if schools are going to open, doesn't it make sense to supply all teachers and children with masks that are made of proper filter materials, layers, and various sizes? Why aren't companies busy designing and manufacturing masks that are much more effective than homemade cloth face coverings? I do know in many areas that is in the works, but probably not completely. Schooling, not just schools, should be considered and funded as infrastructure, as they are the foundations of our country's future, says Kimberly. Andrew says, thanks for the discussion about schools. I think we should also consider what to do about families with younger children. We have a newborn who has not been able to meet her grandparents yet on the advice of doctors. But if we are ordered back into the office, she will have to go to daycare and be exposed to dozens of individuals. What should we do in that situation? We technically have child care available, so we can't use a lack of child care as an excuse at work. But doctors recommend no exposure to anyone if it can be avoided. Does one parent quit their job to keep our family safe? And these are the very real problems that people are facing every day as a result of this.
And very legitimate problems.
Absolutely.
Very legitimate problems. I mean, you know, the idea that you would lose one income in order to keep your family alive or your loved ones or your grandchildren alive is a very tough decision, but not tough enough when you think about what the implications are.
John says, how is it that essential workers have been going to work nonstop for the entire time of this virus and have somehow solved the problems of childcare and working with PPE? But you are all debating how difficult it will be for the poor, oppressed office worker to do the same.
Well, a lot of the essential workers have died. So, you know, let's be real about this. And you look at the numbers of certainly in the medical profession, but
no,
also
she's brilliant.
People
You're
working
brilliant.
In these fields. It's, I mean, come on, mister. Look
That's
at the numbers.
Answer. That's the answer.
Garrett says,
well, the governor keeps
go ahead, Heather.
Making the point that essential workers actually have a lower transmission rate than people who are staying at home. And, you know, I'm relying on what, you know, is said at the daily briefing, but he's made that point any number of times, which to me points to the PPE, right? Having access to good, high quality PPE and having all these good sanitization practices appear to really have an impact. And, you know, as offices reopen and my office is partially reopened, we have, we've been following CDC guidance and the recommended standards by the state, which is you wear PPE and you use hand sanitizer and everybody's desk area is sanitized daily. And we have a small workforce and it would be a big deal if somebody contracted it. So the idea that people have been going to work, I mean, that's true. And they've been following these practices. So that's why it's worked. That doesn't mean that, you know, someone can go back to the office if there's no school for their kids. I mean, that's a different problem. So I think there are two different things there.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters on this subject, and we obviously want to get to a lot of other subjects as well. We have about 45 minutes left with our panel. Also, we have the governor coming up at 11:30 this morning, so stay tuned for that. We will continue all of this after news. Good morning. Welcome back to the Alan Chartok birthday edition of the Roundtable panel. Alan is with us. We also have Judith Eng, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Heather Bruschetti. We have a lot of letters about schools, and I'm going to plow through as many of these as I can get to, and then we'll move on to some other very important stories that I want to make sure we address before our time ends this morning. Kateri says, as a part-time college teacher, I sincerely wish that we could all, by mutual agreement, just take a semester off and teachers and students alike devote it to self-betterment. Students could take on a real-world project related to their studies, do an independent study, develop a reading curriculum, etc. The benefits of this might far outweigh all the hassle of teachers working hard over their summers to develop a plan that will be an imperfect compromise at best.
We go to Carla, who says, my daughter's college announced 2 days ago to switch to an almost all remote fall semester, listing reasons as inadequate access to testing, the inability to control air circulation in older buildings, and the inability to feel confident that college students would practice social distancing. If you cannot count on an 18 to 21-year-old to be careful, how can you expect a 5-year-old to do the same? P.S. Internet as part of infrastructure also would provide some jobs. We go to, hold on, I have an issue. There we go. I think both are, oh, I may have lost Heather. I got Sienna back. I think we lost Heather. Heather, please call back. other letters. Carla says that we got Carla. We go to Sal, who says is a teacher in a local prominent and well-off school district. Heather, are you there?
I'm back.
Excellent. Thank God. All right. Sal says, as a teacher in a local prominent and well-off school district, I am heartened to listen to the discussion this morning. I want to clarify something about PPE. In a meeting yesterday, teachers were told that the district will not be providing N95 masks to teachers, staff, or students. Like everything in education, we were told, too expensive and difficult.
Wow.
And there you go. T says, please don't forget your essential staff that have worked through this time period. Many of us were called to work before phase one began and never got a clear answer on whether it was mandatory. Trump's behavior has allowed administrators to bully their way and put workers in unsafe conditions. Many of us relied on overtime, which stopped back in March, and none of us were given any extra pay. Many contractors do not wear masks, and they get away with it. I cannot tell you how difficult this is. As a keen observer within the system, I can safely say that the schools will not be prepared to handle the logistics required in the fall. We go to Van, who says teachers are not equally dedicated and/or equipped. Also, some parents are working harder at home than when at their workplaces, and they are too stressed to be able to homeschool as well. I worry some children in these circumstances will be disadvantaged. Garrett says, in many spirited social media debates about this, no one addresses the dimension that parents aren't eager to go back to work and be at risk. Are the kids just a proxy for that? The logistics of reopening skyscrapers in New York City are massive. The liability risks scare organizations. Anything on that, Heather? Not so much the skyscraper part, but just the overall business climate?
I've talked to lots of our members who are delaying a full reopening, some till the end of the year at the earliest, because of concerns about mass transit and elevators. And, you know, they certainly don't want to have people come back to work if it's going to create a new spreader event. And so people also can work. A lot of people are working remotely in these circumstances. It's where you can't work remotely that the real challenges come in.
We got this from Matthew, who says, I'm listening to you guys this morning and thinking about how off base your answers are concerning essential workers and transmission/access to PPE. As an essential worker, I do not have access to anything that an average person has access to. Also, we are not dying. I just honestly think we may have better hygiene practices that are forced upon us by a company company policies. We essential workers do deserve more pay and credit for what we are doing. While most America has had a forced break, we had to work extra hours and under difficult and different dangerous conditions than before. Usually I agree with everything I hear you guys say in the mornings, but today the panel is a little off base. I think like anything, when you start talking about this, one size doesn't fit all, right?
I certainly understand that.
We also got in regards to essential workers, Kathy writes, working on equipment that processes, my husband was an essential worker working on equipment that processes medical vials. His company required that he travel around the country on flights where, hardly surprising anymore, the majority of passengers were not wearing masks. He was working in cities with major medical centers where all those with COVID headed for testing and treatment. I'm in an age range that is at risk. He talked to them. They wouldn't budge. He quit. So he's joined the masses in trying to find a local job, and because he quit, he is not eligible for unemployment. Do you keep a job that's endangering your health? Do you quit and not receive any financial support? Terrible choices are required today, but I thank you for being there. And Kathy, we thank you for that, and certainly wish you well. Yeah,
you know, Joe, there are some policemen and cops and teachers and other people who find themselves in exactly that spot. Do you wanna risk bringing home the infection to your family? Do you wanna die? What's more important, keeping a job that doesn't keep you safe, or potentially dying? I mean, it's just. It's a tough one, but I think people have to make some tough calls now.
Yeah, horrible decisions to have to make. Marcy writes to us and says, I am a hospital chaplain and want to give a shout out to the nation's YMCAs. They are providing emergency child care for essential workers. Their system is not perfect. For instance, I can't send my daughter because my local Y is only taking children over 4. But they have been a huge help for my colleagues. My husband and I are juggling care for our 20-month-old between the two of us. Additionally, the Y's methods of keeping kids engaged but safe have been held up as a study for safely navigating children through during COVID. I'm also a college professor and want to say states and counties really need to take an active role in deciding how colleges will navigate this fall. The schools need to make money and fear students won't re-enroll if classes are online. This need for tuition money can overshadow their need to keep people safe. Counties need to focus on health and provide boundaries to school.
It's not only tuition money. It's money from people staying in the dormitories.
Right.
There's a fortune involved in this. Obviously, the state university is in a little bit of a better position, although the president of a state university has to worry about this, too. Then are the people who are running private, not-for-profit, or what we call now independent colleges. They are really feeling the brunt of this.
Some great letters this morning. I just have a few more before we move on. Eve says reopening schools part-time does not solve any of the daycare crisis and will actually hurt the academic progress of children, basically cutting their instruction time if they only attend a few days a week to allow for reduced classroom density. If students were receiving quality full-time remote instruction 5 days a week, they would actually learn more. School districts could prioritize bringing in small groups of the youngest students only who do not do well with online learning, as well as special needs students, and spread them out throughout available buildings. Middle and high school students should be provided the technology they need for remote learning and should stay online till a vaccine is available. This would address daycare needs and safety and education quality all at once. Other countries have done this. Why can't we? I was just thinking as I was reading this, there was a letter yesterday that we didn't get to. We didn't have time for it. But it struck me, and I remembered it only because it was such a great point, which is also a lot of, for college kids especially, and even for schools, teachers are being asked to do phases. So they'll have three groups of students. So it's, let's say they have a class of 18, that you would have three groups of six. One of the problems with that, of course, is that you're then teaching the course three times, which is something else to keep in mind as well.
To say nothing, Joe, of all the teachers, like when Roselle was teaching high school here in Great Barrington, who have five and six classes a day.
Right, and extrapolate that. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so I think that is it for the letters that I have in front of me on the teaching and schools reopening. So I would like to move on to some other topics because there are many. One of the things that Judith brought up in regards to testing was New York City and the testing issues in New York City. Testing bottlenecks threaten New York City's ability to contain the virus. I am sure this is something that will be coming up during the governor's press conference this morning at 11:30 that we will be carrying live here from the Red Room in the Capitol. There is a quote in the New York Times article on this. Honestly, I don't even really see the point in getting tested, said one New Yorker who has waited nearly 2 weeks with still no results. Nearly 4 months after the pandemic's peak, New York City is facing such serious delays in returning coronavirus test results that public health experts are warning that the problems could hinder efforts to reopen local economy and schools, Despite repeated pledges from the governor and Mayor Bill de Blasio that testing would be both widely accessible and effective, thousands of New Yorkers have had to wait a week or more for results, and at some clinics, the median wait time is 9 days. One prominent local official has even promised the drastic step of limiting testing. The delays in New York City are caused in part by the outbreak spike in states like California, Florida, and Texas, which has strained laboratories across the country and touched off a renewed national testing crisis. We go back to April when we were told that everyone who wants a test can have a test. What happened?
I think it exploded.
Go ahead. Heather, go ahead.
I was going to say, I just think it exploded. I mean, we were there. We were doing really well in turning around tests. I got tested on a Friday and had my results Sunday morning, and it was easy. I mean, drive through Albany Med, I didn't have to get out of my car, and, you know, no problem at all. But I guess there's all kinds of problems getting access to whatever the reagent or whatever it is, because there's so much massive amount of testing going on now in other parts of the country. But I mean, the governor did build a huge network of labs that are not national labs, and he was talking about this at his press conference yesterday. And that network is, I think, still doing well. It's about the 30% that have to go to the national labs that have these huge delays, and it's because of the demand elsewhere.
Well, I was making a snarky comment that wasn't this what Jared Kushner was in charge of? And remember when he was going to solve all the testing and PPE and other needs? And I think this points to this, we don't have a national approach, right? Every state, almost every city, they're on their own.
Yeah.
And so when you have these surges in big states like Texas and California now, it's going to have a ripple effect in New York to the extent that those communities are relying on private labs. And I've noticed in the last few days, the heads of these big private labs are sounding the alarm and saying, you know, we can't keep up now. And the projections over the next few weeks are worse. So again, if you don't have a national plan and you allow people to move from state to state, and one state is stronger than the other in terms of masking policies and how quickly they reopen, this is just going to recur. I mean, this is like Armageddon Groundhog Day. We're just going to have these serious problems over and over for the next few months or years.
That was my favorite movie, Armageddon Groundhog Day. Oh, yeah. you know, but one of the things that we've been talking about, the president being back in the White House press room and giving updates this week over the last several days. And let us not forget that on Sunday, there was the interview with Chris Wallace in which he said that, you know, again, making the claim that we had too many testing, there was too much testing in the country, and that it was causing problems. And that, you know, well, and sort of the blow off line was, well, if we need testing, we'll have testing. But, you know, nobody is doing more than we are. And yet you hear stories like this. Where people are and people are waiting. I mean, the reason this is so important, obviously, the health. If someone is sick and concerned and worried, a week is a horrendous amount of time, or 10 days to be waiting for a result. But if it is a more practical test in which they need to have before they can go back to work, before they can reopen their business, before they can go back to their normal life, well, that is very, very disturbing. Alan?
Yeah, it is, and we haven't worked it out at all. But one of the things we've been doing today is discussing some of the ways around it. You know, Joe, at times like this, when some scoundrels are around. You get letters like this one from allegedly from a man named Brian. He said, "You have the unmitigated gall to call Trump a scourge. What we are witnessing today is the direct result in capital letters of too many Jews in power. This will stop when Americans come to realize who is responsible for their chaos." So they're out there. And when you get tough times like this, you get idiots like this.
Man, very disturbing.
Go ahead. The whole idea that testing causes more cases, I think that's so absurd. I had a professor in college, and we were talking about tornadoes, and it was a statistics class, and he said, you know, you can take the numbers and you can turn it into a story about how mobile home parks cause tornadoes, because that's where all the imagery is, that's where all the damage is. I mean, it's just It makes no sense at all. And if anyone thought about it for 2 seconds, they'd realize that. As far as, you know, people being ugly, that's just terrible. And why someone would be compelled to send that comment in is just scary.
Yeah, don't be polluting WAMC airwaves with those horrible statements. But I do want to point out that Trump gives permission for those. People feel comfortable actually.
For the haters.
Yeah. And I do want to say, you know, he's been on a, quote, charm offensive this week. Finally, maybe recognizing the seriousness of our crisis, although I doubt it's going to last. But even at his news conference yesterday, he continued to use the phrases, quote, China virus and radical left mob. So he just can't help himself in terms of dividing and then making it seem okay for that letter writer, supposed Brian, who should go back in his cave and never write to us again. He feels comfortable expressing those anti-Semitic sentiment because of the division coming from the person who's actually the president of our country.
We got this letter from Eliza, who says, "Love the love fest for teachers, but this narrative is not the case for many teachers. Many of them did not rise to the challenge of distance learning. Like before the pandemic, many teachers protected by their powerful union are just phoning it in. Students in high-performing districts do well because their affluent families pick up the slack, providing enrichment at home and through tutors. The pandemic is going to further magnify this disparity in education."
Well, the teachers have no greater fan than me. I'll tell you that right now. And if you haven't been married to a teacher, or if you're not a teacher, or if you haven't been grateful for what a teacher has done for your kids, you know, you don't have any understanding of what you're talking about, as in this case, no understanding whatsoever. You know, blame it on the unions, blame it on the Jews, blame it on them. It's all, that's the way these folks are.
And I would also like to say, to remind people, the teachers have children too. So the same way that I was home with my kids teaching them, my children's teachers were at home with their children, trying to do two jobs at once. They're trying to take care of their children and teach my children and teach their children probably. So, right. You know, I just like to give teachers the benefit of the doubt as well, because they're dealing with the pandemic the same as us.
One of the topics, go ahead.
I think we can use technology. I mean, we can use technology here much more effectively than we are. And where you have a teacher like the one who wrote in earlier and talked about all the things that they did, I mean, let's use that as an example and fill in the gaps where, you know, some teachers are not equipped to do online learning. So let's figure out a way to use the instruction that's being produced elsewhere, at least as a gap filling measure, and make sure that kids don't get off track.
We just have a few minutes before we have to go to a break. I want to go to another story. This one on the census. We talked that President Trump released a memorandum this week suggesting that he gets to decide who counts as a person and that undocumented immigrants do not qualify. This from Vox. The memo concerns who should be counted when representatives are allocated to states following the 2020 census. Trump claims that quote, for the purpose of the reapportionment of representatives following the 2020 census, it is the policy of the United States to exclude from the apportionment base aliens who are not in a lawful immigration status. Thus, if Trump's view were to prevail, a view that is at odds with the explicit text of the Constitution, undocumented immigrants would not be counted. Sienna, let me ask you, since this is your field as an immigration attorney, what, I mean, I don't think many people think this is going to stand up in court, but how do you deal with it in the meantime?
No. I mean, I think this was, you know, first of all, just to address whether or not I'll stand up in court, I mean, there's a 1989 opinion from the Department of Justice, which William Barr was a part of at that time, which stated that inhabitants of states who are illegal aliens must be included in the census count. And then what we had last year was a Supreme Court decision coming down with the citizenship question, where we saw that they kind of insinuated, the Supreme Court did, that they could do a citizenship question, but they wanted to know the rationale behind it, and that's why that failed. So I think this is another case of the rationale behind it. I think this was just a distraction by the president. Because it won't hold water. It just doesn't hold water. When the U.S. Constitution dealt with the enumeration clause, they expected you to count the whole number of persons in each state. That's what it states very explicitly. And the U.S. Supreme Court has held that undocumented individuals are persons. So it just doesn't hold water legally, but I think it was just a distraction by the president.
But it also has to do with the fact that this is just one more way in which Trump thinks he can lead to win the election. He knows that even though Hispanics are, he has a better record with Hispanics supporting him than other groups. But I can tell you that the one thing that he's thinking is, how do I keep people from answering the doorbell? And if you've got somebody who is an unregistered, a person in your household, you're not going to open that door because it may be the ICE, it may be somebody else. That's what he's thinking. The whole idea is to win the election.
Undercount. And an undercount in communities that are Democratic majority states or cities.
We have to take a break. We'll pause on that note. When we return, we'll finish up with our wonderful group this morning. We'll be right back after this. We just have a few minutes before we have to go this morning, but I wanted to get to a couple of things. One is there is an amazing article, and I hope you all get a chance to read it. It's long, and but it's really, really good. It's in the New York Times Magazine this week. It's called The Great Climate Migration, and it takes a look at the effects of course, of climate change and this issue of climate migration. And it has incredible pictures, it has incredible graphs, and is so in-depth. Judith, I wanted to get your thoughts on it, just to sort of take a look at it as a jumping-off point for just the importance of this issue.
Yeah, I think it's a reminder that while we're focused on COVID, understandably, climate change keeps getting worse. And we're so fortunate that this brilliant reporter, Abram Lustgarten, he's with ProPublica, and he teamed up with the New York Times for this piece that everyone should look at. And we need to get familiar with the phrase climate refugees, millions of people who leave their homes because of sea level rise and violent weather and excessive heat. When it's a really hot day, there are a lot of people around the world who can't just flip on the air conditioner or fans. And if people think that this is a problem for other countries and not us, I just remind us of Hurricane Maria and the large number of people who left Puerto Rico and never returned, Katrina in New Orleans. So climate change is here. It is getting worse, even though the cost of renewable energy has gone down. And I think this article with the photographs is magnificent. And I think it reminds us that we need to tackle air pollution and climate change and COVID. I would only add that while COVID is obviously the number one priority, it's an infectious disease. Worldwide, air pollution kills 9 million people every year. So the health effects of driving down fossil fuel pollution is quite significant, and we've got to get back to progress on driving down carbon pollution and really, you know, talk about infrastructure week, really invest in not only renewable energy projects and energy efficiency, but the way homes are heated and cooled. I'm so worried about the New York City transit system collapsing because of budget problems and people not wanting, understandably, to go on the subway. You know, New York City's best tool on climate change is a good mass transit system. It's all connected. You know, do we fund transit? And if we don't, do we see more climate refugees? But that is a phrase we will hear more and more. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see what is unfolding on the climate change issue and the inability of our government. I mean, Trump, you know, has rolled back more than 100 federal environmental regulations or delayed them. So I can't say that COVID is a distraction for Trump. I'd rather him not be busy rolling back EPA regulations. But boy, just like we lost valuable time earlier this year in coming up with a good strategy to deal with COVID, we are really behind the eight ball and missed, you know, we've lost, you know, decades in terms of really having climate justice plans that make sense.
It is. Yes, go ahead.
May I add, I thought it was an illuminating article, this climate migration, because what I see when people come from countries, they mentioned Guatemala, they come to the U.S., they claim asylum, and they don't have the language to describe why they left. All they can say is poverty. It's, you know, I don't have food. I need a job. I need money. I need to support my family. And this just gives up this. For me as an attorney, just gave me better language to couch their asylum claim because they don't have the language to say what exactly is going on and why they had to flee. And also, we're also seeing an increase, further restrictions around asylum. So when you have all this climate migration, we're seeing the government making it harder to make those claims. And we see the refugee numbers going down in the U.S. and you're seeing it in other countries, in other European countries as well. So it was just very sad to see. I know the author mentioned it briefly, but it is very sad to see that we have this issue of climate migration coming up, and these individuals have nowhere to go because countries are closing their borders.
That's a great point. It's an amazing read and a good weekend project for you. It's as I said, it's long and it's in depth, but it's very, very important. We're running out of time. I just want to thank all the people who wrote in with birthday wishes for Alan. As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, Alan's birthday is tomorrow. So Michael said, happy birthday, Alan. You are loved. Thank you for all you have done and are doing, and God willing will long continue to do for all of us. Patricia says, happy birthday, Dr. Chartok. Many, many happy returns of the day. I'm a sustaining member, and I just doubled my monthly contribution in honor of you and your leadership and commitment. I don't know what I would do without WAMC, but there is a strong personal attachment to you as a person, a fearless leader, a humanitarian, and an inspiration. More than 10 years ago in June, I was driving from Louisville to Vermont for a different job, and questioning my decision. I crossed into New York State. The radio was set to pick up the strongest signal, and all of a sudden, there you were, leading a fun drive. I fell in Chartok love almost at once and have never wavered. Such commitment, such eloquence, such genuine emotion and caring, such intellect, such humor. Wow. WAMC is my daily companion ever since. It enriches my life, as do you. Grace writes from Sheffield and says, happy birthday to you. And she sent an adorable drawing and a picture of her dog. I will send those to you so you can see them. Most radio listeners will not be able to see them. Peter said, everyone in the WAMC listening area wishes Alan a terrific birthday weekend. Many happy returns of the day. Alan,
Hope says, thank you for all you have done and are continuing to do with your leadership. You have attracted the best to keep your dream alive. I applaud all of what WAMC stands for and have been a fan for years. And Robert says, good morning, panel, and happy birthday, Alan. The winning of the struggle has been a long one for you and us. Thank you for the awakening that your teaching provided. Our walk will be safer because of you, the gang, and WAMC. So some lovely sentiments this morning, and a very happy birthday to you, Alan.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
We have 1 minute, and I just, Deborah was pleading. I don't usually take requests, but who would like to talk in 30 seconds about the AOC Representative Yoho incident?
Me.
Okay, go ahead. 30 seconds.
If you haven't, all I have to say is watch it online. I think it's going to hold up as one of the most brilliant pieces of political response ever. And so many women relate to what she has said on the floor. And she handled it with such dignity and grace, did not show anger, and really turned it into a reminder of what is going on in our culture. I mean, her floor statement was extraordinary. And I never want to hear Yoho again.
Yo ho ho. I want to thank everybody for being a part of the program. Judith, Sienna, Heather, always wonderful to have you all here. Thank you very much. And to the birthday boy, Alan, have a beautiful birthday weekend. Have an enjoyable and lovely time with your family. And thank you so much, and just enjoy the day for you.
And thank you for your kindness, Joe. Thank you so
very much. Happy birthday. We will be back right after this.